Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. I came across another intriguing question this week. Who influences us to become the people we are meant to be? It begins with five key people in childhood. It could be our parents, grandparents, family friends, or relatives, perhaps a teacher, as I hear so often. As we mature, that circle of influence becomes wider. In today's episode, we're looking at the concept of how childhood memories, family values, and life partnerships shape not only who we become, but how we lead. Mark Rowland is Chief Collaboration Officer at Rocketeer, a company he built that reflects his values and mission. Mark's a systems thinker, entrepreneur, and movement builder who believes collaboration isn't a buzzword, it's a blueprint for regeneration. Just what the world needs. From the legacy of his father and the unwavering support of his partner Danielle, to the entrepreneurial mindset he and his wife have modelled for their children, they've created an environment where love, stability and trust create the conditions for courage, creativity and impact. Oh, Mark, it's such an honour to have you join me today. Your intention is to work with organisations and ecosystems to tackle humanity's most urgent challenges. Who on earth raised you to become this collaborative, intrepid and empowering leader?
Well, do you know what? So I was obviously raised mum and dad in Northern England, and then I left England when I was 22 and moved to Australia by myself. But the things that I always remembered that my mum and dad taught me were very sort of, you know, Northern England has a reputation for being quite a friendly place. I remember one of the things my dad taught me is to smile at everyone that you meet, because you never know, that might be the nicest thing they see all day. And that stuck with me. So I was like, that's something that's so easy to do, is just to smile a lot and smile at people, make eye contact with people. And it then resonates, that kind of builds. So there's some little things there that I can definitely remember from my early childhood. And then I lost my dad sadly when I was in my early 20s. So that was a, you know, young time to lose somebody so influential in your life. So that then caused me to do a lot of reflection and a lot of thinking about, you know, what is life? Maybe I was forced on me at an earlier age than I would have ordinarily done it had I not lost my dad. But that was such a huge impact in my life. To that, I went back and then thought about all the things that I'd done that I regretted. And that list, I prioritized it. And then I remember going through it and going, is there anything I do to fix this? And one of them was, you know, when I was young, I stole some money from my best friend's dad. And I regretted it, like it was on my conscience. I knew I shouldn't have done it, but I did it. And I justified it to myself why I did it, because he wanted me to go to this concert, whatever, and I couldn't afford to do it. And then I saw some money lying around in the kitchen, and I thought, if I take this, I can use it to buy a ticket to go to the concert, but I'll use it with him. So I kind of justified it in my head that it was okay to do, but I knew it wasn't. And after my dad died, when I made a list of all the things that I regretted in my life, that was up there, that was one of them. So what I did to try and amend that one was I kind of figured out, well, how much did I take? And if that person had invested that money, how much would that be in today's dollars? And then I went to a store and I knew that my friend's mom loved these like porcelain little doggy thingies. So I went to a shop and I bought one and I took it to the house and I said, hey, I just have to confess, you know, a number of years ago, I took some money from you and I feel really bad about it. And I hope you can forgive me. And here's I bought them a gift. And they responded really well. Like, I remember him saying to me, wow, that must have taken a lot of courage to do what you did, and thank you. And no, I had no idea that you'd taken the money. So that was not a clue, but he said, yeah, thank you. So that then taught me it's really important, I guess, to do the right thing. And if you're not doing the right thing, then there's nothing to do to kind of fix it. And even if you can't fix it, just acknowledge that and then use that as a way to gauge the rest of your life. So I think having that happen to me in my early 20s was really important.
How do you think that's continued to serve you? You know, those childhood lessons can be so important, but even the ones in our 20s shape our future vision.
Oh, yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes, as I'm sure you have as well. Like, I live through life very entrepreneurially focused, so I tend to jump into things. I have a very high tolerance for risk. And sometimes I do things that I then later think, oh, gee, I wish I hadn't done that. And again, it's how can you learn from that? And there was only one time in my life I contemplated suicide, and that only lasted a few seconds. But that was a big moment, obviously, in my life, to have even thought that suicide was actually a good thing to do, to then go in and go, okay, well, what led to that? Why the heck did that even happen? And what can you do to make sure that that doesn't happen again? And then later in life, I was working in a community, and we sadly had 3 people in the community suicide. So then at least I was able to reflect back on my experience, which then helped me to think through not just, I guess, like in my head, acknowledge that, yes, I understand what can happen in someone's life that might lead them to actually do that. So I guess have empathy with the person, but then also know, okay, well, yeah, these are the things that I think we can do in our community to try and help. And then I ended up working with the US Air Force, and over 170 active airmen suicide a year there. So again, it was like, what is that? And so taking all those different life experiences and then trying to internalize it and look at, you know, what can you then do to either help yourself, help your immediate family, or help the world, you know, as you try and expand the impact and the reach that you have. Because I recognized very early on in my career that I did have, I guess, the opportunity and to impact lots of other people. You know, I was very, very open to sort of speaking, having speaking engagements, leading workshops, facilitating things with people. It, you know, it then really does allow you to realize the impact that you can have on others. Another really influential person in my life was my first ever coach. There was a time when I became a CEO for the very first time, and it was not the job that I thought it was. I was assuming being a CEO was like really cool, and it would be like my dream job, and how could I not love it? And then when I became a CEO, I realized that it was actually very lonely, that you didn't have any peers anymore. So the first time in my life, in my working life, I had no peers, and then I didn't have anyone above me anymore. And that never happened. All I had was this board of directors that I met with occasionally. And then everybody below me was looking to me for direction. And I was a bit lost. And I'm a big believer in, you know, the universe bailing you out as and when you need it, as long as you know what to ask for. So I remember sitting there and just sort of meditating on, I really need help. And I would love for some support. And anyway, the next day I was going through my mail, and a PwC alumni magazine came through the letterbox, and normally I just threw them straight in the trash. I never looked at them. But for some reason, I unwrapped the plastic wrapper, I opened it up, and on the center page, there was this picture of a lady. And basically the headline was, if you're a CEO and you're lost, I can help. And I was like, well, thank you, universe. That was pretty cool. So I called her up and began working with her very soon thereafter. And that lady was called Michelle Duval, and she had a company called Equilibrio. And she became my coach for 18 months. And I learned a lot about myself, a lot about my beliefs, a lot about how to communicate from doing the work with her. And then after that, I decided I wanted to try and do the things that she'd done with me to others. So I asked her, you know, what courses did you do? What books did you read? How did you learn to be able to do this skill? I want to be able to do that myself. So I knew I'd never be as good as her at it, but I knew I could be pretty, pretty good at it. So I did everything that she said. I read all the books, I did all the courses, and I became a qualified coach myself so I could actually coach others. And that teaches you how to ask amazing questions and hold space for people. And one of the things that she told me to look at was neuro-linguistic programming. So I poured myself into that. And that's a phenomenal mechanism to allow you to understand yourself better, and what you say to yourself and your thoughts and your beliefs and how you then turn up for others. Yeah. So that was a huge part.
You seem to be quite an introspective person, and those qualities don't seem to be as common in our children these days, who are even struggling with critical thinking, to tell you the truth. How do you think we could encourage the next generation to become more introspective, or at least critical thinkers, in such a diverse information environment?
Well, I think the challenge now is access to tools that do our thinking for us. So I had no access to ChatGPT when I was a kid. I mean, God knows what I could have ended up being if I had had ChatGPT with me when I was 12 or 20. It's a very different world that we live in now. And I know that I've seen people like my kids and my kids' age have some conversations with ChatGPT that they would not necessarily have with another human being. So they can be very open with ChatGPT and ask questions of ChatGPT. They may be scared to ask and get answers immediately back. So I think maybe there's a little bit of a loss of like critical thinking, but now it becomes critical prompting. Like, how do we learn how to ask the best questions of an AI that has access to a language model that can actually be useful to us? That's one thing I learned with coaching, was it was often the question, the quality of the question that you ask was the important thing. And with AI, it's technically the quality of the prompt that you ask. But I think also what I've seen with the kids today, not to generalize, but you know, from what I've noticed, is they're not getting as much outdoor time, play time, stuff as like I know I did when I was a kid. And I remember somebody telling to me that there was a psychological study that kids that were born in the 70s, which was me, we were let out into the world by our parents at a very early age to go out and explore. And it was okay for me to say to my mom, hey, I'm going to go riding today. I don't know where I'm going, but I promise I'll be home before it goes dark. And she would say, sure, go for it. And I would. So that gave me, I knew I had the courage to do it. I know I had the opportunity to do it. I added a lot of initiation to then go and do whatever I wanted. And I would, sometimes I'd ride across, like maybe ride like 20, 30 miles and go see my grandma or go see a friend. Now today, if my daughter said to me, hey dad, when she was like 12, we should have said, hey, I'm going to leave home today. I promise I'll be home before night. Not sure where I'm going, not sure what I'm going to be doing. I don't know if I'd have had the same response as my mom did. So then I was imagining, well, what then does that not teach the children? Like, I learned how to take risks. I made a lot of mistakes. You know, I broke, you know, I cut myself. I hurt myself. I had to get stitches for things. There's a lot of stuff that I was allowed to do as a kid that maybe I've not given my kids the same freedom to be able to do. And then what's the impact on their development?
Why do you think you haven't given your children the opportunity you had? There's so many reasons that parents these days have perceived threats that they think might affect their children. So what is it about the world that's changed so much that our generation, who had freedom, were maybe less capable of giving it to our children?
Well, I think it's probably access to media. Maybe the world was different in the 1970s and 80s than the world is today. Or maybe it's the same, but now we can see more of the negative stuff on TV. I know I was taught Stranger Danger. You know, I remember, you know, those TV with adverts on TV in the 70s with this kid and a cat called Charlie. And Charlie explains to the kid that he wasn't supposed to go and see the guy that was offering to come and show him his puppies. So I remember watching those adverts on television when I was a kid in the 70s. But yeah, I guess now with access to social media and everything, we can actually see all the negative stuff that is happening, and maybe we're more aware of it, and then that causes a bit more fear in us as well. That yes, maybe my child might be abducted, because I remember seeing on TV or social media that somebody in my neighborhood had their child abducted. And you know, maybe some of that stuff happened in the past, but it just wasn't fed back to us. So we couldn't get that feedback loop of knowledge to then have that fear override the freedom that we were going to give our children. I was always definitely, I mean, in terms of the parenting of our children, I was definitely the more free-spirited one, and my wife is more the risk-averse one. So that gave us a good balance. I would definitely allow my children to go off and do stuff and take risks. And, you know, as long as it wasn't life-threatening stuff, allow them the freedom to be able to do stuff. And my wife, she would definitely allow them to, but she was certainly a lot more cautious than I was. And I remember we did a values exercise with somebody, and safety was like one of my wife's top values. And I think it was like 7 out of 10 in mine. So it was definitely something that she was more focused on than I was.
Recently, you were celebrating 25 years of marriage and a wonderful Yes. life with your wife, and celebrating her. Having that insight into the support from a partner in life, how important has Yeah. that been to you as this man who is out there risking everything to have impact in the world?
Having access to that safety net is... I've never been a trapeze artist or walking the wire or whatever in the circus. I imagine having that safety net underneath is quite a huge psychological benefit to someone who's starting out and learning their trade. So having that support as an entrepreneur, or just even if you're not an entrepreneur, an intrapreneur, or just someone who is out there pushing the boundaries and taking risks, knowing that you've got that support behind you, I think is really important. And when I look back at the only time in my life that I've contemplated suicide, the reason that I did was because I didn't believe that I would have that safety. So I made a decision to personally guarantee a whole heap of stuff for my startup that I probably shouldn't have done. So I basically, without even really thinking about it, I put everything that I owned personally on the line as collateral against the company, which included the house that we lived in, everything. And then when the company was potentially going to go under, I then had the realization that I was potentially going to have to go home and tell my wife and kids that we're going to lose our house. We're not going to be able to afford to have the kids in the private school that they're in. And I was all the negative stuff that was flowing in my head that might cause that. And then I snapped out of it. Luckily for me, that I was like, nope, I think my kids do need their dad. Because I was in my head, I was thinking, well, if I died, then they'd get the insurance money. And, even if the company did go under, they'd still get the money from the insurance and they'd be able to keep the house and stuff. And, that would be okay. But then when I snapped out of it and realized that, no, my kids probably do need their dad more than the embarrassment of me losing the house. But when I went home and explained the situation, my wife said, well, it's not happened yet. Because I was basically given 5 days to raise $5 million. That was the task, or lose the company. And she said, well, you've got resources. You can, I back you. You can do this. Give it a go. So I did. I didn't sleep for a few days, but raised the money that was needed to be able to keep the company afloat, and then ended up selling the company. So that was good. But I guess what I learned from that was maybe I should actually be a little bit more upfront with my wife when I'm making these split decisions of should I, shouldn't I personally guarantee the entire debts of the company. And we were an e-commerce company, so we were buying stuff. So we spent $4 million putting orders in for shoes. I personally guaranteed every one of those dollars without really thinking through what that meant. You know what I mean? Whereas if I think I'd ever sat down with my partner and just said, okay, the company will not be anything if I don't do this. Somebody has to personally guarantee this. I'm the only one that can actually do that. Maybe we would have restructured things. Maybe we would have changed the ownership of the house. Maybe I put it in her name, not my name. Maybe there were some things that I would have done. And then if it had have got to that point where we might have lost everything, that I wouldn't have been as negatively impacted.
I think it's great that she supported you through every decision you've made, whether she was included or not. That takes me to my next point of interest, which is how much you've travelled around the world. I mean, you've lived in the US, you come from England to Australia, you've moved backwards and forwards and in and out. How do you think your entrepreneurial spirit in relation to taking you places where you never dreamed has really shaped your children and your family with their worldview?
Yeah, well, being entrepreneurial is a lot about, I guess, acknowledging what it is you want to do, taking steps to do it, being comfortable to take on certain risks to be able to do it. even though you don't know how everything's going to pan out, which is different to being an entrepreneur, which is launching a company and has additional risk involved. But any human can be entrepreneurial. Only a few humans are probably going to be entrepreneurs. So I guess being entrepreneurial definitely is a trait that my kids have picked up on. I think Danielle, my wife, has sort of through osmosis become more entrepreneurial just by living in my orbit and surviving in my orbit. She was a little bit entrepreneurial herself because she moved from Adelaide to Sydney with in the same way that I moved from England to Sydney. But one thing I do want to stress is I was told that work-life balance was a really horrible phrase to utilize because it implies that work is not life. Whereas you could say something like life balance, of which one component is work and one component is what I do outside of work, or other components what I do outside of work. Or you can utilize the term work-life integration, which is where you try and integrate your work into your life. And I always tried that. So I brought my kids to work a lot. I tried to explain to them what it was that I was doing at work and why that meant I might not see them as much as I would like to. I took my daughter was in a TV, the first TV commercial I did for this shoe company, the e-commerce company, she was in it. So I was like, cool, I can bring my daughter into my work and do that. So I always tried to bring the kids in and have them understand what it was. My wife did the same, just so the kids could understand what it was that we did for a living, how it was that we generated money to pay for their stuff. That, you know, the money just didn't come from a tree. That so if they wanted a, you know, something new, that the reason that we were able to pay for that was because we had these jobs, and it was the jobs that kept us away from them at some time during the day. So that was, I think, a really important skill for them to learn. So then taking my kids to America. In America, they have a very different like schooling system, very different culture. I think that was a really amazing experience for the kids. So in America, they have this, they don't have like elementary school and high school. They have a three-tiered system. So they have elementary school, middle school, and high school. So there's only ever 4 years of humans in a school, the age differential. And I think that's important, and that helped them. And then my daughter, I remember she was Entrepreneur of the Year for her school. So she had an entrepreneurial class. I'm sure my son did too, as one of the subjects that they had at school. So that was something they wouldn't have had in Australia. And she had to, like as a 10-year-old, come up with an idea for a business and come up with a business plan and then create a prototype of it and then go to it. They had like a demo day at the school and all parents and other kids went around and then they picked the winner and she won. And just seeing the confidence in her and the realization that if she sees something that she doesn't like, she could just do it. Same with my son, you know, so they're both, I think, been very well impacted by that entrepreneurial energy. And then also realizing, as you said, like going to different countries, realizing that they're still safe. It's okay. It's a great experience. Not just going on holiday, but actually living in America has taught them a lot, I think. As it taught me, you know, leaving England and coming to Australia. And then I left Australia, went back to England. And then I went from England to Korea, lived in Seoul for a bit, and then back to Australia, and then the US, and then back to Australia. You know, you realize that no matter where you are, there's systems that are still the same. There's frameworks that are still the same. And luckily for me, most of the places I've lived in speak English. So that's been helpful.
Your profile states that your purpose in life is to channel your intrepid spirit and infectious enthusiasm into inspiring collaborative action and leading movements that accelerate the regeneration of our planet. How important is that impact to you today as we stare down the barrel of so much uncertainty?
It's everything to me. I think the whole idea of regeneration is something that is very interesting. You know, not just like leaving the world in a better place than what it was when you came into it is essentially the aspect of sort of regeneration. And there's a lot more nuance than that. But if I look at what was the world that I was given when I was born in 1970 and what is the world like today, it's definitely not better than what it was when I came into the world. So I've got a lot of work to do. And for me, the reason I use planetary regeneration is so that literally everything is within scope. So that could be, you know, nature and biodiversity, that could be ocean health, that could be lack of pollution, that could be the atmospheric pollution, that could be human happiness as a species on a planet, that could be the happiness of all of nature. And we're helping nature to flourish itself. And then because we are part of nature, we are flourishing as well. So obviously, if we wipe out the pollinators, we're going to have a massive food shortage, which is then going to massively impact the human population. So it's realizing all the connectivity of that. And I was lucky enough, early in my life, I was in my late 20s to go and study at MIT, systems thinking and system dynamics, which really then helped me to understand how all these different systems actually work and connect, and the cause and effect and stuff. And then reading people like James Lovelock and Bucky Fuller, just really understanding some really cool concepts around, you know, what can we do as an individual? What can you do as a movement builder? And recognizing that in terms of the skills that I have that are, you know, unique to me, there's a bunch of levers that I could pull to support planetary regeneration, and then trying to figure out what is that. And a lot of that is around inspiring people to maybe see things different or realize the impact that they can make, bringing people together, like building a movement. Now, these are all the things that I absolutely love to do. And I acknowledge that I have skill in that. So that's what I want to utilize is those things to the fore, bring people together and inspire change.
What top skills do you think we need to be imparting to the successive generations who will inherit these challenges for that future?
Yeah, one is understanding how the planet works. I think that's an absolutely critical one. The amount of people that do not understand how the carbon cycle works, that do not understand how the water cycle works, that do not understand where humans get food from, they don't understand the relationship between, you know, chopping down forests and then impacting the atmosphere and impacting the ability to keep species alive that we may then need, I think is critical. So educate people on how the planet works, which means you need to really understand, you know, systems level stuff. So systems thinking skills, you mentioned critical thinking skills earlier. You know, all those sort of skills are really, really, really important, I think. But if you haven't got the empathy, if you don't understand what's going on and what you might lose. So a lot of the conversations I have with people that maybe make decisions that are different to the decisions that I would make, when you sit down with them and ask them, you know, why did you make that decision? Oftentimes it's just their worldview is different. They're not doing it to be spiteful. They're not doing it because they want to wreck the planet. They're doing it because they just don't have any other knowledge. You know, they're doing making the best decisions they can with the resources they have. So then it's, well, how can I motivate you to get more resources? How can I motivate you to learn more and see the impact of your decisions and to realize you have a choice? And there's, yes, you could do that, but you could also do this. And that might help you as a human be a more healthier, happier, more well-being person. And then it might help your family. And then it might help your community. And then it might help your country. And then it might help the whole human species and all of nature on our planet. And isn't that a good thing to do if all you have to do is this one little thing different? And then the skills of collaboration, the skills of sharing. You asked me how the world is different. I remember it was normal when I was a kid to go and ask the next door neighbor to borrow a tool. That was normal. Like, my dad would know all the people that lived in our little village and who had the power drill and who had this and who had that. And he would go and ask them if he could borrow it on Sunday afternoon from 2 till 4. And they would know that they could come and ask my dad for his help with something if they needed it. So in the village, we had this sort of bartering arrangement where people knew who had access to what, either technical skill, a tool, a something, and we shared. Nowadays, I know that every single person on my street, probably if they want to do something, if they want to trim a hedge, they'll probably just go to Bunnings and buy a hedge trimmer. They wouldn't think to knock on the person next door and say, "Hey, do you have a hedge trimmer? Could I borrow it?" So then in my street, we have 10 houses, and 10 of us have lawnmowers, whippersnippers, hedge trimmers, blowers, and we probably only use it for about 15 minutes a fortnight. We could all share the same one. So I think teaching people how to collaborate better, share resources is probably a key one. And there's I remember one of the Buckminster Fuller books that I loved was the Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. And he said, imagine if you believe that Earth was actually a spaceship flying through space and had all of humanity on it. And we're flying through space and we just have to do with whatever we have. We can't bring in any other resources onto our planet because we don't know how to do that. So all we have is we're limited to the resources that we have. Would we be making the same decisions if we all believed we were living on a spaceship? There's a whole heap of things that we do different. So I think it's like educating people and sharing those stories.
Well, I think our school education systems definitely need a bit of an upgrade given the skills you've just outlined. Mark, it's been very interesting. It's been very thought-provoking. And I think we may have to select another subject to fine-tune this conversation down to next time. But thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for reaching out, Kim. Pleasure too.
Mark Rowland, reflecting on how the world has changed since 1970 and how raising children today means helping them navigate a world far bigger than our local communities, while staying grounded in values that truly matter. Collaboration starts long before boardrooms, businesses, or global movements. It begins with the people who raise us, the partners who steady us, and the values we model for future generations. Mark's story has highlighted to me that stability enables risk, love enables courage, and trust enables regeneration of families, communities, and our planet. As you reflect on this conversation, I invite you to ask yourself, what am I modelling for children watching me in my home, school, or even community? And how can collaboration become a daily practice, not just a professional one? Because what we teach our children today shapes the humanity of tomorrow. If you'd like to teach your children lessons in humanity, you might be interested in my children's books, written for ages 2 to 8, in rhyme and beautifully illustrated by my friend Di Skelly-Heron. You'll find them on my website. And please reach out and connect from there as well. All of those contact details are in the show notes. I look forward to you joining me again for another meaningful conversation next week.